I have to correct myself. There was two local bands opening up that show, the Del Counts and the Steel Roven. Now, luckily, everybody knows Sonny Bono had a great sense of humor, so he obviously used his sense of humor make things work, correct?
Yes. Yeah, he was good. I wish I had a videotape of that, because it turned out to be okay.
Now, in your understanding, is this the only time Sonny Bono ever performed alone without Cher?
As far as I know.
I have in my notes that you played the role of a ticket agent in the Ross Hunter Universal film Airport.
Yes.
Which was filmed right here,
mm-hmm,
partially here.
A lot of it was.
How'd that come about?
Actually, it was interesting. One time I knew Bobby Darin pretty well, the singer, and he was married to Sandra Dee. And I got a meeting with Ross Hunter, who produced the movie, when he was in town. And they were looking for some extras, local extras. And I went up to see him at the old Sheraton Hotel in downtown Minneapolis. Obviously, I dropped Bobby Darin's name. And I said, I doubt if you know this, but that one time we were pretty good friends. And obviously, you had Sandra Dee in a couple of your films. And she was one of his favorites. So that, you know, the recognition, and all of a sudden he looked at me through different eyes, and so that helped me. So he arranged to get me this speaking role. It's a small one, but at least it was speaking.
Well, and, you're visible in the
right.
movie.
So I actually had two scenes. One was with Gene Seberg, but I was strictly background as a ticket agent. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was I had a conversation with Maureen Stapleton, who was also in the movie. Yeah, that was pretty exciting. It was about four nights worth of filming, late at night out at the Minneapolis airport. We started at 10 o'clock and wrapped things up around 4. They had several sets going at the same time. But I got to know all of the stars that were in there. I got to meet most of them.
And that was?
Burt Lancaster and Dean Martin. Barbara Hale, Lloyd Nolan I met, Maureen Stapleton.
George Kennedy?
George Kennedy. I never met him. I didn't see him. I would kind of, you know, I was dressed up in their Trans Global Airlines, you know, uniform. And so I'd walk around and where they're filming, and it was fun. So I got to see him, and they'd have you go into makeup, and I'd be in makeup with Maureen Stapleton, because we were doing this thing together, and it was it took four nights to do that. Well, actually, it took two nights to do the one with Gene Seberg, which wasn't that big a deal. It was only big because they had so many people out there, and the assistant director, each time they would film a scene, they'd have to look at the pictures. You know, they'd take stills and make sure everybody was positioned exactly the way they were an hour ago or the day before, and that just took time, a lot of time.
It's a little more slow-moving compared to being a on-air radio personnel.
Yes, and the scene with Stapleton was, the first night we did it, they had a camera on a dolly. The camera was moving, following her as she's walking up to my ticket counter. And so the camera was coming down this way, and she was moving this way through the crowds. And then she'd come up to me, and then she did her line, I did mine, and boom, and that was the end of the scene. Well, then the next night, they had the camera out here, and they had to take my part of it. And so it was really interesting to see the movie being made.
Now, looking at the internet, I came across a concert that was hosted by WDGY on June 6th. 1969 at the Minneapolis Auditorium with Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, the Peppermint Rainbow, and the Corporation. And the concert was billed with the band names and also the WDGY All-Americans, Johnny Cant, mm-hmm, Jerry Brooke, Scott Burton, Gene Leader, and Jim Dandy. Who came up with this name, the All-Americans?
Just, I'm sure Scott Burton was largely, we'd have meetings and we'd think, you know, we should call our disc jockey something. So that's what we came up with, the All-Americans.
Scott Burton left during your time there,
yes,
correct?
Yes, yes. He was program director, and I was music director. And when he left, Then they made me program director, and he went on, I think, to Washington, D.C. I'm not sure.
Now, I understand that in early 1970, you were invited by Bill Carlson and Nancy Nelson to attend a Christofferson concert here in town. What's the story?
They had an apartment downtown Minneapolis. We were invited, and Bill said, we have another couple going to be over there. So we joined them for cocktails, and the other couple was John Denver and his wife, Annie. And John had been part of the Chad Mitchell Trio.
The folk group.
Right, up until that time, and he had also written some songs, one of which was a big hit for Peter, Paul, and Mary, Leaving on a Jet Plane. Well, we spent the evening together, and Denver had mentioned that he had a new album coming out. He just signed with RCA Victor Records. And the album was Poems, Prayers, and Promises, and he wanted to know if he could stop by the radio station, WDGY, and play it for me and get my reaction to it. So we wound up having lunch at the old ranch house out in Bloomington, and then went back to the radio station. I put him on the air, interviewed him a little bit, and we played a couple of cuts, the title cut, and then Take Me Home, Country Roads, which ultimately became the single out of the album. And then later, when it came out as a single, John called and wanted to know if I'd be playing it. And I said, sure, I'll give it a shot. Made it a pick hit of the week. He had a pretty good following here, Denver did, based upon being local, that type of thing. But the song didn't really catch on too well, so it went a few weeks, and I was just on the verge of taking it off our playlist, to be honest. And John called, and he wanted to know. I said, no, please, give it another week. And so I decided I'd call some friends of mine who work for stores at their other stations around the country.
By the way, let's run through those other stations real quick.
Well, we had WTIX in New Orleans, WQAM in Miami, KXOK in St. Louis, WHB in Kansas City, WDGY here in the Twin Cities.
And Coma?
Yeah, KOMA in Oklahoma City.
So you call them and encourage them to play the song?
Well, I ask them what they thought of it and if they give it a shot. And this one fellow in New Orleans I knew fairly well, and so he gave it a shot. And then the next thing you know, it started catching on around the country. And then the rest is history, as they say.
Correct. It became a number two on the Billboard Hot 100, certified as a gold record, meaning 1 million copies were sold on August 18, 1971. So when you first heard the song, Take Me Home, Country Roads, did you think it was a hit?
Yeah, I thought it had some certainly promise. Mm-hmm. It was not quite like a lot of the songs we were playing at that time in 1970, 71. I have to search my memory bank a little bit more to remember the hot songs of that time. But I would think that Three Dog Night was a popular group at that time, Joy to the World, and, you know, rock and roll. And Take Me Home, Country Roads was more country flavored and strong folk, at least, you know.
Okay, and you were given credit for helping launch John Denver's solo career in his 1994 autobiography called Take Me Home, written by John Denver and Arthur Tobiah.
Yes, yeah, that was nice. John had told me he was writing this book, well, later when he had finished it, and he was just a nice guy, and Annie was terrific. We were at their parents, her parents' home a couple of times for parties, and they lived out in Prior Lake, and one time we threw a party where I lived at a townhouse in Edina, and I invited John and Annie, and then they both showed up. In fact, John brought me a gold record, you know, what RCA had put together on a nice little display and presented it to me at the party, which was impressive. And by this time, you know, he was a kind of a record star. So it was something for our friends and the people we had invited to the party to be there, and in walks John Denver. It was kind of fun.
Now, there is a very famous night in musical history here in the Twin Cities that you happen to have been a part of, and that was April 3rd and April 4th in 1970, when Joe Cocker's Mad Dogs and Englishmen show came to town, and you were the MC for both nights, I understand.
Yes, it was the opening of the Depot, which is now, what, First Avenue, downtown Minneapolis. And they had these two groups come in. Actually, Joe Cocker. It was one group, but there were several singers and personalities within that group that could stand on their own. And I was tapped by Danny Stevens. Danny's reasons, he convinced Alan Fingerhut, who had the majority interest in opening the Depot, to hire me as an MC. So that was fun. It was a big two nights.
Anything stand out in particular, like maybe the 20 musicians they had on stage?
Well, yeah, and I wish I could think of a well-known saxophone player. Name escapes me, but and also a female singer. She was...
Rita Coolidge.
That's it, Rita Coolidge.
All right. And Leon Russell, apparently.
Leon Russell, you've got
director.
It. Yeah, you're...
And do you recall the sax player?
Bobby Keys would be the saxophone player.
Okay. And that was being filmed at the time, right?
Yes, they were making a documentary of Joe Cocker's tour, concert tour, mm-hmm. and they called it Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Now, I was not there that night, unfortunately, but I understand the place was quite crowded.
Oh, it was packed.
And the story goes that they had completely sold out all alcohol by 8 o'clock p.m.
Well, I don't know.
Now, that film, the documentary, Matt called Mad Dogs and Englishmen, which... was filmed over their United States tour. You are apparently in that documentary.
Mm-hmm. For their appearance in the Twin Cities.
Okay.
I have never seen it, but I understand it was fairly big in England.
Now, who were some of the other famous musicians and celebrities that you interviewed in person and over the hit line on WDGY?
Oh, there were many of them. Andy Williams, Ringo Starr. I did an interview with John Lennon, Helen Reddy. Some of these were friends of mine. Tony Orlando, Frankie Valli, who I knew very well. Neil Sedaka, Bette Midler, and it was a... kind of a long list of the singing artists and personalities of the day.
So how long does your stay at WDGY last, Johnny?
I left there in March of 1977.
Why did you leave?
Well, they changed the format, and I didn't get along with that. And
what'd they change it to?
They went to they called it Y11, which was, they were trying to fight off KQRS, which had FM in this time period, of course. FM had a big, strong foothold in the music market and the ratings, and they were a big, big factor among our demographic. While we're still playing hit tunes and 18 minutes of commercials every hour, they were playing music. So that they thought they'd compete a little bit against... KQRS and go with more of the Steve Miller bands and the long versions of the other songs around, thinking that they could do it on an AM frequency, which they couldn't. So I left, and then shortly thereafter they went country and became very successful as a country station. And then, as you know, it was sold, and the call letters became dormant, and then 1130 was occupied by KFAN.
So what did you do after WDGY?
Well, I decided I thought I would get out of the broadcasting business and go into the advertising business. So a friend of mine offered me an opportunity to become executive vice president at his advertising agency.
What was that called?
Metropolitan Advertising. His name was Gary Holstrom, and so that started kind of an advertising career. Obviously, I was familiar with advertising. But I decided I'd give that a chance, and then before you know it, ran into Ron Majors, who was at KSTP, Channel 5 at the time, and he had mentioned to me that Tom Ryther was leaving the radio or TV station. And Tom Ryther, in addition to his sports director job, hosted Bowling for Dollars. And he said, you'd be perfect for that show. He said, why don't you give Stan Hubbard a call? Hubbard, who owned the TV station, still does, and see if you can set up an interview. And audition. So I did, and sure enough, it was set up. They videotaped me interviewing some of their secretaries downstairs at Channel 5 on their makeshift Bowling for Dollars set. And they sent the videotape off to Claster Productions, which actually owned the show. And then several weeks later, I got the word that they wanted me to do the show. So I went back on the air, but doing television.
And we also need to mention your time at WCCO-FM.
Well, that started after the TV show went on the air.
Okay.
I got a call from the manager at WCCO-FM, Paul Jacobson, and he said, I thought you were going to get out of the broadcasting business. And I said, no, I decided I'd do this. And he knew I was working the advertising side of the street. But we set up a lunch, got together with him and Paul Stagg, who was his program director at CCO-FM, and they were interested in me doing some weekend and substitution work. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to do it. And that's when I started at WCCO-FM in December of 1977. That went until June of 1984. In the meantime, they had changed their call letters from WCCO-FM to WLTE-FM. And they changed those call letters in January of 1984. I left in June of 84 and then came back in September of 85.
At WLTE.
Yes.
FM. And that's
basically
that's,
the same station.
Is that light? That was light rock or easy listening, so to speak?
Right.
So you and you stay at WLTE for how long?
I was there from December of 77, stopped in 84 for about a year, and then from 85 until just recently, 2011.
December 2011?
Yep. And also, in the meantime, after Bowling for Dollars went off the air, it was a couple of years that a group of us decided to, I was handling the Metro Bowling Proprietors Association, and a few of us thought it'd be kind of fun to bring back Bowlerama, because there was no local bowling show on the air, and bowling was still very, very popular. So we resurrected Bowlerama and put that back on the air on KMSP TV Channel 9. And that was on the air for, oh boy, for a few years. I can't remember. About 4 years, from 83 to 87.
So if we go way back to KLEX AM in Lexington, Missouri, that's May 1958, and you are in the radio broadcasting business all the way through December 2011. That's quite a run.
Yeah, that 50-some-odd years.
So looking back at your time on the radio, is there one highlight or several highlights that you recall?
Well, I really enjoyed my tenure at WDGY. That was a fun radio station. We got involved heavily with the community. Our disc jockeys, we had a basketball team where we would challenge and go out and play the faculties of schools to raise money for their favorite charity. And that just, that was fun. We did a lot of that. And I got very up close and personal with a lot of recording artists because you could get close to them at that time. I don't care how big they were. I remember, well, just recently, you know, Phil Everly passed away.
Right.
I remember they had a new record coming out called Bowling Green, and they were with Warner Brothers. And one day I got a call from Phil Everly, and they were coming through Minneapolis, and they wanted to know if they could stop by and play us this new song. And I said, sure. I'd never met him before. And to me, they were somewhat my idols going back to my teenage years. And, you know, all their hit records were just anthems. And so they stopped by, and I remember sitting back in my little office area and chatting with them for, oh, better part of an hour or more, and listening to Bowling Green. And that was great to be able to sit there and talk to them. Well, Elton John would never do that in a million years, for example. I mean, and you couldn't even get close to Elton John now. I mean, even if he were appearing in concert, there's just no way, unless he knew you. But it was very open, and I enjoy those relationships like that.
What is Arbitron, and how did it affect the radio business?
Well, Arbitron, of course, is a rating system, and they normally would use a diary situation. They would canvass the market and pick about 1,500 people out of a market, extensive interviews with the people, and they would pay the person as long as they would keep an accurate diary of what they listened to. In my terms, I never really trusted them, mainly because it was a lot of top-of-mind awareness. The average person would lie about what they were listening to, or they put down a station that, for example, if they were older, they would feel that, ooh, I'm going to write down WCCO, because no, I wouldn't want them to think I was listening to WDGY or KQRS or some other station. Now it's they have these personal people meters, which they use. It's like a cell phone, and they attach it to them or put them in the pocket. And it's much more sophisticated. It will actually read what signal is being listened to wherever you are. If you're in your car, you change a station, it will record each time you change it. It's pretty sophisticated. And so, the people are being paid to do this.
So you can't cheat in the...
No.
That way. Now, on October 28th, 2006, I understand you were inducted into the Minnesota Broadcasting Hall of Fame, a tribute to your 53-plus years of continuous broadcasting. I would have to assume that would have been a good achievement.
Yes, it was very flattering and probably one of the biggest highlights of my career, because it's a fairly large event for broadcasters and broadcasting, and that was quite a night.
Do you listen to the radio these days?
I do.
What do you listen to?
Well, I have to admit, I purchased a car a few years ago, which had satellite radio, Sirius XM satellite radio. So that's basically what I listen to, because they have unlimited channels. Every musical taste that you could possibly crave, as well as old radio shows.
Right.
It runs the gamut, and I find it very enjoyable. Once in a while, I listen to some local stations. I listen to my old buddy, Paul Geiger. He's at 7:40 a.m., WDGY.
Right.
Greg Borgen purchased the call letters. So he's on in the morning from 7 until 11 every day. So I tune him in quite often. That's about the extent of...
What do you think of automated radio?
Automated radio?
Where they have automated DJs playing automated music, pre-programmed.
Yeah. Well, obviously they do that for a reason, and that's financial. And they can have one of, say, like a major broadcasting unit will have one of their big disc jockeys in Detroit, for example, or Chicago, and they can do voice tracking and send out the a 3-hour show, which you can do probably in 20 minutes, because all you're doing is just doing the voices, or the voicing, voice tracking. You could service 6 or 7 radio stations that you own, and that's and not pay that disc jockey who's doing it 6 or 7 salaries.
Did people ever tell you when you were at WDGY, wow, nice job, you work 3 hours a day?
Oh, yeah, we get that a lot. And, of course, you'd have to remind them that that 3 hours was not just on the air, because I was, over the course of time, doing program directing, sometimes news directing, in charge of the music, doing production, making commercials, producing commercials. So it was a long day.
So roughly how many hours were you at the studio a day?
If I did a 3-hour show when I first started, I'd probably get to the radio station at 8:30, and I'd be there until 6.
Let's get caught up to January 2014. Are you still living in town, and what are you doing these days?
Still living in Edina, where I've resided most of my career here, kind of enjoying the retirement life. I do a commercial now and then. I have my own advertising agency. After Gary and I parted ways back in 78, I formed my own, Canton Communications, Inc., and I still handle a few clients. Other than that, it's a lot of golf in the season and a lot of bowling in the winter season, so it's fun.
Are you ever out in the public somewhere and someone hears your voice and goes, wait a minute?
Once in a while.
I heard you on WDGY. Are you Johnny Canton?
Yes, I'll get that. Yep. I'll get that every once in a while.
They still remember your voice?
Yes. It's strange when we were told, which was just before Christmas in 2011, that they were going to change Light FM to Buzzin' Country. They allowed me to do the last live radio show at Light FM.
Oh, at Light FM.
That was on a Friday, December 23rd, 2 days before Christmas. The station was still playing Christmas music, so I did the 2 to 7 time slot on that day, the final live show on Light FM. And they allowed me to say my goodbyes, and if I wanted to talk to listeners, I could, that type of thing. So it was pretty gratifying.
Do you recall the last song you played?
No, but I'm sure it was probably Feliz Navidad, because we were wall-to-wall Christmas music at that time.
Johnny, thank you for taking the time to stop by Sunrise Sound today and share with us your story about your time in the broadcasting business.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I thank you very much, Tom.